From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Filmmaker and journalist Jennifer Jordan recently finished a documentary where she tries to defend Greg Mortensen and restore his reputation. Mortensen's book, Three Cups of Tea, was wildly popular. It tells the story of him stumbling into a Pakistani village in 1993 and promising to return to build them a school. And there's no disputing Mortensen has built dozens and dozens of schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But 5 years ago, a report by the CBS News program 60 Minutes and an expose by the writer John Krakauer raised questions about Mortensen's story. In Jordan's film, Mortensen says in the end, words mean nothing. All that matters is that those kids get educated. But is that true? One of the questions we'll ask today, should people look past these possible fabrications and see the bigger picture in Greg Mortensen's work? And what really did happen in 1993? Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West's podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, providing wealth management to the Intermountain West for over 30 years. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now, you've heard the story of what is sometimes described as the fall of Greg Mortensen. In 2011, the CBS News program 60 Minutes broadcast a report that raised serious questions about the story Mortensen told in his book, Three Cups of Tea. The book was, as you probably know, nothing short of a phenomenon. 50 months on the New York Times paperback bestseller list. It inspired donors to spend tens of millions of dollars to help build schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that book is built around a remarkable story in a small village in northeast Pakistan. It's at the foot of the Karakoram mountain range. And as Greg Mortensen tells it in his book, he stumbled into the village after failing to summit the mountain K2. This was in 1993, he says. And the people took him in. They nursed him back to health, promised to return, he said, and he will build them a school when he does. The 60 Minutes report and a lengthy expose by the writer John Krakauer say the story didn't happen like that, certainly not in the way Mortensen told it. And not only that, that Mortensen distorted the reality of life in the region, that he lied about being kidnapped by the Taliban, that he exaggerated the influence of terrorism in that part of the world. It also raised questions about financial mismanagement. The New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who has described himself as an admirer of Greg Mortensen, wrote a piece shortly after these allegations came to light. And in the paper, he admitted being troubled by some of the financial allegations. He also said he was willing to give some benefit of the doubt to a man who has risked his life on behalf of some of the world's most voiceless people. And in many ways, that's a big conflict in Mortensen's story and in the documentary film now produced by filmmaker and journalist Jennifer Jordan. She just released that documentary. She defends Mortensen's story and his work, and she's joining us. John Krakauer is joining us as well. And we're going to talk about what we know, the differing stories, of course, here. Jennifer Jordan, the author of the book The Savage Summit, The Life and Death of the First Woman of K2, her documentary film about Mortensen and the allegations against him is called 3,000 Cups of Tea. She's joining us today from the studios of radio station WCAI. That's in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And Jennifer Jordan, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
John Krakauer is the author of several books, of course, including Into Thin Air. His newest, Missoula, his investigation into Greg Mortensen's story, was published as an e-book in 2011. I mentioned it there in the introduction. He's joining us today from the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. And John Krakauer, welcome to you.
Thanks, Doug.
I guess I wanted to begin, if we could, just briefly with both of your first meetings with Greg Mortensen. Jennifer Jordan, when did you first come to know Greg Mortensen?
I came to know Greg in 2000 when I was heading into the north side of K2, and our team stopped, of course, in Islamabad, as teams do, and Greg came to the hotel to help us kind of navigate the tricky logistics of getting up through the Northwest Territories of Pakistan. And then a year later, a little over a year and a half later, when we were invited back to K2 to do another expedition, another filming, I called Greg to say, you know, are we insane to think that we can get into the mountain just months after 9/11? And he again helped us with our expeditions. And then I interviewed him when he came through Salt Lake to talk about the Taliban. He was at that time probably one of the most knowledgeable Westerners about the rising threat, and stayed in touch very minimally, but certainly watched his meteoric rise through the years.
Would you call him a friend?
I would call him a colleague more than a friend. The interactions were more professional than friendly, but yes. I mean, if the question is he a friend, he's become one.
You say in your film that you didn't begin the film to exonerate Greg Mortensen, but so why did you make a film?
It's a great story. I've been a journalist 35 years, and 60 Minutes was part of the reason I became a journalist. It really imparted my how to investigate, how to interview. So when I, after having known Greg these years, and I watched the report on 60 Minutes, I immediately said something is not right in my understanding, not only of Greg, but also of that area. I'd been through that area twice at that point, three times now. I'd seen many of those villages, and I'd seen many of Greg's projects, schools as well as health facilities and now vocational centers, but back then it was mostly porter latrines and schools and different projects. So I wanted to know if Greg had lost his way or if something was awry with this report.
John Krakauer, when did you first come to know of Greg Mortensen?
I was introduced to Greg in 1997 by the great American mountaineer Tom Hornbein, who was on the 1963 Everest expedition. He's a close personal friend, and he had just met Greg, and Greg told Tom and then me this amazing story of stumbling into this village and, you know, the kindness they showed over many weeks and how he set their broken bones and was thinking of ways to repay them. And it blew my mind. And he talked about how during that first meeting, you know, at the end, he impulsively said, I promise to build you a school. I will build you a school. And it changed the course of his life. And I was blown away like everyone else. I mean, very soon after that, I wrote Greg a check for $20,000. And over the next 5 years, I wrote him gave him more than $75,000 at a time when he had burned through $1.5 million of money that others had given him, and he was foundering. He was on the brink of bankruptcy. I really admired him. I did a big fundraiser for him in Seattle. I convinced thousands of people to give to him. I was one of his biggest supporters. He says that in Three Cups of Tea. You can read about it. And then in 2004, his board quit en masse, almost the entire board. And the treasurer told me, including Tom Hornbein, who had been brought on to clean up CAI. And Hornbein told me Greg wouldn't listen. He just, when we tried to tell him, suggest ways he should, you know, make this a reputable organization, he just stopped talking to us. So the board had to quit. He wouldn't communicate. The treasurer of the organization told me Greg was using CAI as his personal ATM. So I just quit giving. I felt betrayed and hurt. I just walked away. And then in 2004, the organization contacted me and said, hey, why'd you quit giving? So I told them. I wrote a letter, which Greg saw. I know he saw because I was told that he saw it, in which I explained that, you know, this isn't right. You need to clean up your act. You need to get a board of directors that will hold them accountable. Until then, I'm done. I was really crushed like everyone else. I really believed in him. He offered some hope in this horrible war in Central Asia. And then in 2010, I finally got around to reading his book. And, you know, the alarms went off. The book is full of lies, you know, that are, if you just look closely. So I said, man, this isn't right. And I went to CAI and I talked to some current and past board members and say, what is going on? And I found out that, you know, a whole bunch of board members, at least half a dozen, had quit because of Greg. They thought he was corrupt and he wouldn't listen to them. And when they tried to say, we need to investigate Ghulam Parvi or someone else, they'd be told to leave him alone. Don't go there. So I not only resented that I'd given him 75 grand and he had wasted a lot of it, but I felt even worse in that I had helped persuade thousands of well-intentioned well-intentioned people to be fleeced by Greg Mortensen. You know, they didn't know that he was wasting more than half the money they'd given him. They didn't know that these stories that inspired all of us were fiction. They are fiction. It's, you know, there's a mountain of evidence to prove they're fiction. And you know, Jennifer now has a film to dispute that, and she's wrong.
We're going to get into that. I want to, if it's okay with both of you, back in a little bit to sort of, because this comes up, John Krakauer, in your book, your expose, Three Cups of Deceit, this question, and Jennifer raises it too, is of whether Greg Mortensen was just this, had this kind of non-Western disposition, that he didn't think like most Westerners, therefore he was kind of clumsy and... But then there's the other side of that, which is maybe he was irresponsible and controlling. And Jennifer, I want to get your perspective on that. You seem to be making that case. You tell of Mortensen's upbringing, how his father set up this hospital in East Africa. He talks about growing up there and developing this kind of, I think he puts it, sort of third world perspective. Would you say something about that?
Yes, Greg is the first one to admit that he has made big mistakes. He says so in the film. He is not a CFO. He is not good with money. He is not someone who, you know, is every dollar that came in for Greg is kind of he saw a potential books to be bought for a child. He's $100. He saw potential children teacher's salary. He did not think, gee, you know, here's $1,000 coming in. I can hire an accountant with this, and I can, you know, get some good attorneys around me. That's not the way he thinks. It obviously was a crucial mistake. And for me, and in looking at this story, it really comes down to, and having put my boots on the ground and my eyes in the villages, it comes down to what is the result? The result is over 450 projects in three and at least two of the most difficult areas of the world right now. And some he's doing something right. USAID has put $14 billion into Pakistan. And I, as far as I last knew, they don't have a roof to show for it.
Okay, Jennifer, we're going to get to that question, what he's accomplished. It's an important part of your film, and there's an important contention, I think, to be had from John Krakauer. But I want to stay on this point for just a moment. Mortensen says in the film that when he's in Asia or Africa, he says because he grew up in this developing world that he feels like he's one of them. And John Krakauer, I want to get you to respond to that. Let me play a moment, though. We're going to hear from Greg Mortensen in this clip from Jennifer's film. Also, Tara Bishop, his Greg Mortensen's wife.
I really can function in that environment better. Here we have strategies and business plans, and we have numbers and charts and... And over there, you can't do anything unless you first have a relationship. I see the world as fluid and dynamic, and my whole life has been like that since I came back to the U.S. I spontaneously married my wife when I was, I think, 38, maybe 37, after 6 days.
He really does see things from outside the norm, and in that is a lot of creativity. And it may, you know, it can drive me crazy in how he loads a dishwasher, but when he talks about other things in the world, I'm always like, wow, because I'm a conformist, more, you know, much more a follow the rule kind of person, and he is a what's possible kind of person.
So that's his persona, John Krakauer. How do you respond to that? Because that's something you write about in your book as well.
There's a side to Greg that is exactly like that. But he also, you know, he's very calculating. A lot of that is a persona he's manufactured very deliberately. I mean, Yeah, he's not good with money. But you have to remember that we all recognize that back in 1999, 2000, Tom Hornbein came on the board and was asked to be president specifically to help Greg. Yeah, he wasn't used to hiring accountants, but Tom's job, and Greg acknowledged it, was to convince him, Greg, it's not your money. This is you're getting, you know, tax subsidized dollars. You can't just do what you want with it anymore. And Greg, you know, reluctantly agreed. But then whenever Tom said, Greg, you got to get I mean, Greg, till the time of the expose, he never got any receipts from anybody. His staff often falsified them, fabricated them, but he deliberately just, you know, would not adhere to the law. And you know, that's and you know, he talks about, I get it, once the money started, the incredible success of Three Cups of Tea, it was amazing. And I at first was thrilled for him. But what people don't know is, yeah, the money was $23 million came in a single year. And that's an avalanche. But he acts like it's an accident and he can't be held responsible for that. He was actively trying to bring in that money. He doesn't tell people. At the same time he was soliciting donations, people were giving him $30,000 a pop to do these speeches. Now, they all assumed, I know because I asked people, that he was donating that money to charity. Why wouldn't he? He's this, you know, he doesn't have a mind for money. Well, he was putting that in his bank. Not $1 of that $30,000 of speaking engagement, and he had hundreds of them went to the charity. He was, you know, the charity paid for him to write those books. They bought him computers. They gave him a big advance. They paid his co-author. He didn't give the charity a dime of his royalties until the 60 Minutes expose. So, you know, if Greg and when people would ask him, and he was being flown around on, they spent $2 million flying him on charter jets. They spent $4 million, you know, on buying his books to give away. Many of which of these events would end up in dumpsters, but he got the royalties from those books. They spent $5 million advertising those books. And when people would ask him, they'd see him in Bozeman, gee, you're flying private jets, man, you've hit the big times. Oh, you know, don't worry, the charity's not paying. The president of Costco or some other executive name is paying. He was, you know, actively, deliberately lying to cover up that he got rich. He says he didn't, and he had to give back $1.2 million. The attorney general found out that he was ringing up his credit card for family vacations and iTunes and luggage. I mean, this is not a guy, you know, Greg was sloppy about financing, but he was very meticulous about his own money. Meticulous about public relations. Anytime some reporter, some journalist would come to Afghanistan or Pakistan, Greg would make sure that journalist, he talked to his staff, that he micromanaged. They saw no villages he didn't want them to see. They only saw the best schools.
Okay.
The schools would get a fresh coat of paint. The kids would get new uniforms. This is true when Jennifer Jordan went to make her film. It was all stage managed. That's your humble, shambling, you know, Gandhi, the new Gandhi.
Jennifer Jordan, there's a lot there. Questions, you don't deal with a lot of the particulars in terms of the money questions, the questions of royalty. You do make some references toward the end of the film related to the private jet thing, and it was, as one former board member said, those were justified costs to get more donations. But what do you want to say about John Krakauer's accusations and others related to the money question?
Well, as you said, Doug, it's quite a laundry list. And for me, the bottom line in all of this has been that the Attorney General of Montana, after a year long and God knows how many millions spent on that investigation, found no criminal wrongdoing. Yes, he found that, and the board admitted, and the board and Greg had come to an agreement of what he would pay back. And the board was remiss, as the film points out, in not getting that money back from Greg. For me, the bottom line and the question that I kept asking myself in putting this film together and in trying to get a lot of Krakauer's as well as Tom Hornbein's as well as other critics in the film, all of whom refused, is that I saw the schools. I have been through those villages with and without Greg, and saw many places without a fresh coat of paint, but they did have children, and they did have teachers, and they did have incredible pride as a village for that school. So
But Jennifer, what's your larger point there? What you're saying, I guess the question, what John Krakauer has gone through and he does this in his book, in his expose, is he goes through this litany of financial problems. And are you suggesting that, yes, there were problems? You're contending they weren't criminal. But you're saying that they can be seen as excusable in the interest of this larger point. That is sort of a particular theme of your film, is it not? That
it's not only that I'm contending. The Attorney General is asserting. He said that was the finding of the report. So it's not just my contention.
Sorry, you misunderstood me. I'm not suggesting anything in terms of, we can talk about the legalities and what was found in this is the Montana Attorney General's report. I guess what I'm saying is, do you concede there were financial problems, but that they should be excused on some level for the larger case that you've made in the film?
Having spoken to former board chairs and members of the Institute, I would say yes. They all knew that there were problems with the financing. There were problems with Greg getting receipts. There were problems with his traveling through these areas. But because Greg was the sole fundraiser, nobody else raised a dime in the organization. And Greg himself brought in the organization's $80 million and by himself raised the $25 million that is in a sustainability fund as we speak, that they were not overly concerned with the, and, you know, again, I don't have in front of me Krakauer's list or his proof of this laundry list of allegations that he's coming up with. I am just relying on what I saw on the ground, the villagers that I spoke to, the people that did agree to be interviewed for the film, and the Attorney General of Montana himself saying there just wasn't enough here to find criminal intent.
But he did have to give back $1.2 million.
Yes, he did. And that was a figure that the board itself had come to the agreement of with Greg prior to the 60 Minutes report. And as the film says, as Abdul-Jabbar, the former chair of the board, says, we as a board were remiss in collecting it.
John Krakauer, you want to respond that there was no criminal foundation here?
There was grounds for charging with fraud, as I talked to a number of government prosecutors who said that. They found no criminal wrongdoing in Greg's case because he hired a small army of lawyers, some of whom were getting $1,000 an hour. This was all paid for by donors. There was no criminal wrongdoing found on Greg for the same reason that the government and the SEC never seems to find, the CEOs of brokerages and banks guilty. It's always the little guy. I mean, it's really hard to prove fraud. And the Attorney General, bless his heart, there was one assistant attorney general working in this case full time, and she was up against this army of the top white shoe lawyers in the country, including the IRS guy in charge of nonprofits. He left, and then Greg hired him to say, well, how do we beat the law? I mean, so the fact there's no criminal wrongdoing means nothing. You know, Jennifer's misrepresenting what the AG found. They found a lot of wrongdoing, and it's all there in the AG report, and you can read it. You know, you read Three Cups of Deceit. She says, I'm not familiar with Krakauer's litany. It's all spelled out in Three Cups of Deceit. I have confidential memos from lawyers, Greg's own lawyers, saying, wow, Greg seems to be violating IRS regulations. You know, he could be liable for $27 million. It's there in my book. It's an actual report. The wrongdoing is undeniable. And the fact that the board, Greg surrounded himself with enablers, colleagues and friends. Any board members or staff who criticized him or questioned him, he just froze them out. I mean, that's what happened to Hornbein. He was frozen out. The treasurer who accused him of wrongdoing in 2004, the board at the time of our investigations consisted of Greg and two of his most loyal adherents who, they lied for Greg themselves. When 60 Minutes, a few days before their show aired, they asked the board, so, what about all this money, Greg's? He hasn't been paying any royalties. He's been getting all these fees. And they made this false statement. The three of them said, Greg has gone for long periods of time without a salary, and he personally has donated hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years. It turns out he donated that money 2 days before the show aired because he knew he was about to get busted. He didn't donate, and it wasn't a donation. He was paying back a fraction of what he had taken from our organization. He never, ever went a period with any period. He never missed a single paycheck. I went through all his financial records. All this stuff, I assume Jennifer has read my book. If not, you know, I suggest she give it a look. And it's all there. I'm not making stuff up. This is, you know, meticulously researched. There's nothing in that book that I couldn't verify with multiple sources and multiple documents. You know, Greg, I don't deny he built a lot of schools and did a lot of good, but not nearly as much as he claimed. And, you know, it's not – Jennifer gives him credit for Greg single-handedly raised – he raised $80 million. That's amazing. But it's not Greg's money. The donors gave him that money because they trusted him to tell the truth. They gave him that money because they believe the stories in his books, and they trusted him to not waste that money. And he has wasted probably half of that $80 million by hiring corrupt friends, by not asking for accountability, by, you know, just wasting it himself. Yeah, he's built a bunch of schools, but what's amazing is not that Jennifer doesn't deny that many, many of those schools are no longer there or never were there. They only exist on paper. He has a lot of schools. A lot of them weren't well run. The question
wait,
is,
Jennifer, what does Jennifer agree to or not agree to about the
that
number
there
of
are schools?
Schools
there? Jennifer, please, if I didn't interrupt you, I'd be grateful if you would not interrupt me. What I meant to say is that Jennifer, I think you would agree that some schools Greg has claimed to build are no longer operating or were never built. And if you don't believe me, I will send you this. I'll send you the information. Well, let me say one more thing before you go back to Jennifer, is that, you know, unintentionally, I've gotten hundreds of emails and Skype calls from Greg's staff and people in Afghanistan and Pakistan complaining that, you know, our teachers isn't getting paid, our school was shut down, you know, I'm not getting my scholarship, I've contacted CII and I'm not doing anything. I'm the go-to guy. My email is spread around. I'm the guy who calls up CII, and I've been doing this since 2011 to say, hey, you might want to know that, you know, you have 40 teachers in Azad Kashmir that you were paying who were just fired, and they were unaware of that. And then I get back this letter, no, you know, that's the government of Azad Kashmir said we no longer need their services. Well, that's not true either. They're desperate for, I mean, I guess I'm saying that, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. And I have ample documentation for every claim I've made, and I'm happy to share it with Jennifer. If she hasn't seen my book, I will email her a copy as soon as I get off this show.
You are calling yourself the go-to guy on this, and yet it's hardly been a secret that I've been doing this film for over 3 years. And why didn't any of those so-called whistleblowers, why didn't any of those so-called critics talk to me or want to talk to me or agree to talk to me? Tom Hornbein told me no. Gordon Wildsey, the treasurer you keep mentioning, told me no. Over and over and over, I've been refused these interviews from critics, including yourself, and most importantly, 60 Minutes. This is not about Three Cups of Deceit. This is about what 60 Minutes put on the air. That is the focus of my investigation, not your accusations.
Go ahead and finish, Jennifer, and we'll get to that question, because it is one that comes up. Why, John, you didn't want to talk to Jennifer? But go ahead, Jennifer, finish your point. Sorry.
No, we can go there now. I mean, it's just, you know, this is a frustratingly, you know, once again, John is just putting out this. He knows that the people listening will have absolutely no way to verify unless they all go and reread the book. So it's just a very frustrating litany of accusations that are with a lot of unnamed sources. A lot of his sources have already, I mean, Parvi, you mentioned in Pakistan, he's already been convicted of, I believe he's serving jail time for embezzlement. So, you know, your sources.
A lot of them are questionable.
There's so many particulars here. I want to get to some larger points, and particularly to the question of what happened in 1993 or didn't happen in Corfe. But let's do get to the question, Jennifer Jordan, that you raised. John Krakauer, why not talk to Jennifer Jordan for her film?
I emailed with her over a period of days back and forth, and I don't trust her. I had never met Jennifer. The first time I had ever communicated her was when she asked me to be on her film. And I've heard, you know, she's been, you know, so I asked her some hard questions. I know she's been saying bad things about me for a long time. That's fine. But if I'm going to be on your film, you know, I need to know if I can trust you to represent what I say. So I asked her a number of very basic questions. What did you think of Three Cups of Deceit? Do you believe the Greg stories are true? She refused over repeated emails to answer a single question. Furthermore, you know, she said, I have no agenda. I'm just going to go where this story leads me. You know, 2 weeks after I denied her request, she produces this trailer on the internet that makes it clear that she is out to, you know, she's going to present that Greg was wronged, which is fine. But one thing she didn't say is she's not trustworthy. One of the people she interviewed for her film was Marvin Kalb, the well-known journalist. And he, before he agreed to the interview, he said, you know, I don't know anything about 60 Minutes. I'm not going to talk about that. I didn't see the show. He said, you know, you cannot use this interview for fundraising. The trailer was a fundraiser. So the first iteration of the trailer, there's Marvin Kalb, you know, being used as to fundraise. And she edited to make it look like he, you know, was slamming 60 Minutes. He wrote back to her and said, Jennifer, you know, you have totally misrepresented your agreement to me. You lied to me. You know, I want to be out of this film. And she took him out. But by that point, I had known that. And I'm not going to tell people that. I actually urged Hornbein and everyone else who asked me to go on her film. I said, I'm not going to do it because I don't think she's trustworthy. But I think you should do it. Just be careful not to believe her promises. And as the Marvin Kalb thing proved, she's not trustworthy. You can't believe her promises.
Jennifer,
see, this is you're saying that I lied to Marvin. I did not lie to Marvin. I used a piece of what he said about 60 Minutes, and I've made it very clear in that cut. He said, if they take something to air, they better have checked their sources. That's the piece I used of Marvin Kalb. And for you to misrepresent my friendship with him is just plain wrong. As far as the demands you sent me, they were proprietary. You asked me where my money was coming from. You asked me what my release date was and who my distributor was. I hadn't even begun editing yet. And as anybody knows, as a filmmaker, those are not answers that you're going to give to the public. And as far as the first time you and I spoke was via email, that's wrong. I interviewed you in 1997 when I was doing a profile on David Brashears. And so, it's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, again, you're just, you know, waterboarding me with accusations. As far as, you know, Jennifer said some, you know, terrible things about me over the years. We're both public figures, John, especially on this conversation about what CAI and what Greg Mortensen have or have not done. And we should be open to public scrutiny. I have grown a very thick skin as a journalist over the years. And I welcome people's, you know, comments and criticisms and whatnot. And as far as, you know, it's very easy to sit in judgment after having refused to be part of the film and you know, the Tom Hornbeins and the Marvin Kalbs and the Yous saying, you know, we don't want to put our voice in there, but we will be more than happy to criticize it once it comes out.
Okay, Jennifer, let's take a break right now. We're way past our break, and because I do want to get to the question of what, in fact, happened in Corfe. Obviously, differing points of view on this particular matter, and it is one of the central aspects of the film, and of course of John Krakauer's work as well. John Krakauer, his book criticizing Greg Mortensen's story was published in 2011. It's called Three Cups of Deceit. Jennifer Jordan's new documentary film addressing allegations against Greg Mortensen is called 3,000 Cups of Tea. We have links to all of this on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to understand the very tumultuous story of Greg Mortensen, who of course wrote that wildly popular book, Three Cups of Tea, about his efforts to build schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And most everyone agrees his efforts have educated tens of thousands of children, many of them girls. But 5 years ago, some journalists, among them the writer John Krakauer, say they uncovered fabrications in Mortensen's story and allegations that he mismanaged millions of dollars in donations. The filmmaker and journalist Jennifer Jordan has just released a documentary that defends Mortensen's work, and that's the reason we're having this conversation today with Jennifer Jordan and with John Krakauer both. Jennifer Jordan, you say in the film that by questioning the essential story, that first story that Greg Mortensen tells in Three Cups of Tea, of stumbling into Corfe, that by questioning this story, that critics are calling into question Greg's entire life and legacy. Before we get to the particulars of the story, how important are the particulars and truthfulness of that story to this larger story, do you think?
Let's take a step back. And Greg admitted that the book written by David Oliver Rellin, the late David Oliver Rellin, was truncated in its representation of how and not how he got to Corfe, but how long he stayed at Corfe. The book was truncated from a three-day village to village to a three-hour. And I'm sorry, it was a three-hour visit that Greg made, and it was the truncation happened with other villages he visited within the time frame. In any case, Greg went to Corfe in 93, according to the people that I spoke with on the ground in that village, and as well as...
But Jennifer, doesn't that bother you that he truncated that and didn't say that he had?
Well, you know, David Oliver Rellin truncated it with the editor Lee Kravitz in New York. And Greg, one more mistake Greg made in not demanding to read the book in galley before it went to press. Yes, it was
But you don't say that in the film. You don't say that in the film. So are you saying right now that Greg Mortensen had nothing to do with conflating that story? And because that, it's a big one. that John Krakauer, which I'll let him speak for himself, obviously, makes this contention that it's a fabrication. And he didn't admit it. But you're saying that was his co-author that did that.
I'm saying there is no fabrication in the fact that Greg went to Corfe in 93, as far as my research goes. There was a truncation of the story about going to Corfe and then back to Skardu and then Kané and then Corfe again 2 years later. So that story was narrowed down. Evidently, now I wasn't in the conversation with Greg and David and Lee Kravitz, but I understood it as David Oliver Rellin and Lee Kravitz saying, no, it's too many stops, too many villages. It doesn't matter if we truncate. And Greg, to his incredible detriment, didn't insist on it's important that we go from village to village to village and have the book. When Greg first took the book to New York to try to sell it, it was 1,000 pages. And potential publishers said, oh, no, Herr Mozart, way too many notes. You've got to cut this thing down. He found David Oliver Rellin, and it was cut down.
John Krakauer, go ahead, because I'm sure the contention you'll make is the point I'm going to
try to get. Greg has made this point over and over again. It was, compressions and omissions. That's simply patently untrue. It's a fabrication. Greg now admits that Greg still didn't go to Corfe, but that's just a red herring. The film, Jennifer keeps saying he went to Corfe for 3 hours. So what? That has no bearing on the greater lie that is the first, 100 pages of his book, which is mostly about how, it wasn't just a few days he claims to have spent in Corfe. Let me read the passage, one of the key passages. Now, bear in mind, before I say this, she claims that Greg had, it was his co-author. Well, even if he didn't read the book until after it came out in hardback, he had a year to ask his publisher to correct it before the paperback. And he's had dozens of printings since where he could further make corrections. He never did that. I'm not buying that, I would have liked to change it, but I didn't. He could have easily pointed out out. This is a fabrication. You need to fix that. Greg never did that. He doesn't get off so easy. It's like this ball player who said, yeah, that I didn't read my autobiography. You know, don't believe a thing that guy wrote. Greg can't get away with that. But let me read, before you bear in mind, Greg spent at most 3 hours in Corfe by his own admission. This is the early pages of Three Cups of Tea, Greg's book, after he's so-called supposedly stumbled into Corfe. And I quote, from his base in Haji Ali's home, Mortensen settled into a routine. Each morning and afternoon, he would walk briefly about Corfe, accompanied, as always, by children tugging at his hands. Off the Baltoro, out of danger, he realized just how precious his own survival had been and how weakened he'd become. He could barely make it down the switchback path that led to the river. Wheezing his way back up to the village, he felt as infirm as the elderly man who sat for hours at a time under Corfe's apricot trees, smoking from hookahs and eating apricot kernels. After an hour or two of poking about each day, he'd succumb to exhaustion and return to stare at the sky from his nest of pillows by Haji Ali's hearth. Each day, as he grew stronger, he spent long hours climbing the steep paths between Corfe's homes, doing what little he could to beat back the avalanche of need. He set broken bones.
Doug, can we move on?
And did what little he could with painkillers and antibiotics. Word of his work spread. This is his words. And this has all happened in 3 hours? I don't think so. I mean, this is a fabrication.
He says now it didn't happen in 3 hours. I don't understand what the point of all this is.
Why hasn't he corrected his book? Why he's allowed this book? He's never made any statement on his website.
He's been busy building 450 projects in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Jennifer, it's not like he didn't have time to do this. It's not an either or. You have a responsibility to tell the truth. Lance Armstrong was kicked off his foundation for lying about doping. His foundation did a lot of good for a lot of people. There's been a lot of, you cannot betray the public trust like that and expect that no one will care. People, you get on my case for
public trust has not been betrayed in the fact that the schools exist. The children, 150,000 children.
Where do you get that number? Greg, nobody at CIA knows how many schools are there. They haven't had someone on the ground in Asia for 3 years.
They have not.
Ask them right now who they have on the ground. Now, no one's auditing. They sent $4 million last year. They set up CII overseas. Let me explain.
Have
this.
You
this is
talked
important.
To the new board? Have you talked?
I
to
have
the new
talked
board?
To. I have corresponded with the new executive director a lot about this. CII was set up by Greg several years ago.
Did they tell you they haven't had any audits? They haven't counted the schools?
My sources in Pakistan and Afghanistan told me that no one has. The new executive director went to Kabul and it was so dangerous he never left his hotel.
One of your sources is in jail. So I'm not sure who
that source is in jail for embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars from CAI, and Greg let him do it. He is finally in jail.
But he was still one of your sources. So can we move on to the larger issue of how you have written an entire book on saying Greg couldn't have gotten to Corfe in 93, but now you're saying, well, maybe he did go for 3 hours?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
I'm
not at all. I'm saying Greg never went to Corfe at all, and I can prove it.
How do you know
that?
How can you prove it?
In the book itself, I know that. I know that because this is a diversion, but in the book itself, Greg never claims that he was on Corfe's on the south side of the river. Ascoli, the village you drive to, is on the north side. In the book, it says in the book that Greg was on the south side the whole time, when really he was never on the south side. Greg never, when he wrote the book, he didn't think he had to explain crossing a bridge. Twice in the book, he explains that he didn't cross a key bridge because he thought he needed to cross a bridge to get to the Ascoli side. There's all kinds of other evidence. There's never been a bridge between the snout of the glacier and the downstream side of Ascoli.
Because this is something that John Krakauer has been writing lately in Medium. You don't actually address this point in the film, and I wondered why.
I didn't address it in the film because, for me, it's so easily provable that there was a bridge, at least in 2006. I found a satellite image of one. And in 2010, I found another satellite
image. But was there a bridge in 93?
You've never shown those, Jennifer. You've never shown those.
We don't know if there was a bridge in 93 because when I spoke to NASA, they told me that the satellite imagery was not highly resoluted enough in order to see something that small. We didn't have Google Earth back in 93. And so, no, I mean, there's no photograph of Greg crossing the bridge in 93. But I have two, I found two anthropologists, two Canadian anthropologists, who confirmed that when they were in that area in the 90s, they used that bridge right where Greg says he crossed to go back and forth. And don't believe me, don't even believe the anthropologists or the satellite imagery. You can see very clearly, even in the most recent satellite imagery, which John uses from 2011, when the bridge had already been washed away, but you can see ancient trade routes that converge to the river on the north side near Ascoli, on the south side, and then presume, and then continue on the other side of the river toward Corfe. Those are ancient trade routes that allowed these villages to communicate and travel among each other.
John,
they
had
a bridge there. You can see it clearly.
What
do you
say to
that? I have a picture. I'll send it to you, John.
Yeah, okay. The picture's from 2006. He was there in 93.
No, you said there was never a bridge. I'm telling
I believe that. So you send me the picture, and I'll agree there was a bridge in 2006.
You actually told me you'd apologize if I gave proof.
I said, if you can prove there's a bridge in 93, I will absolutely apologize. I'm still waiting. But here's my bigger point. We already know by Greg's admission and Darzny's that if he was there at all.
This is Scott Darzny, I should mention.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. Greg has said himself that he didn't spend a single night in Corfe. So this whole, was he there in 93 for 3 hours or not, is interesting, but it's a red herring. Let's just ignore that for now. Did Greg spend weeks in Corfe, as the most crucial story in the book is all how he spent weeks in Corfe and to repay these people for their kindness? You know, he set their broken bones, and then he stood out one morning, put his hand on Haji Ali's shoulder, and he said, and I quote, "I'm going to build you a school," he said. This is 93, not yet realizing that with those words, the path of his life had just detoured down another trail, a route far more serpentine and arduous than the wrong turns he'd taken since returning from K2. "I will build a school," Mortensen said. "I promise." So never mind if he was there for 3 hours. The whole book unfolds around this promise he made allegedly in September 93 after spending weeks in Corfe. That's the point. So we can, he said, she said, we can argue about whether he spent 3 hours or didn't. That is kind of beside the point. The bigger stories are, was he kidnapped by the Taliban, and did he spend 3 weeks in Corfe getting nursed back to health? And the answer to those stories is no.
Okay,
story is 150,000 children who otherwise would not have been educated have been educated. And those 150,000 children are one less in the potential radicalized children. Because when a child in Islam is educated and can read the Quran for themselves, they realize the radicalization happening around them in the Taliban and ISIS. So that, to me, is the bigger picture.
Let me
one quick thing, Doug. Just one quick thing.
Are you going to talk about the radicalization question?
Yeah. Okay,
that's a contention that you make in the book. John, we don't have time to get to that. It's a point that I brought up early on, and people can go through and process that. It's not something that Jennifer deals with in the film. John does talk about the question of whether or not these were radicalized areas, and there's obviously a dispute there. But since we're running out of time, I want to get to Jennifer's larger point that does come up, at least in the film, and get you to respond to it. Jennifer says, if your intention is, and others, or critics, to improve the organization, which is to say the Central Asia Institute, then if you wanted to clean things up, that this is not the way to do it, that what you're doing is bringing an organization to its knees, that you're jeopardizing the good that has been done despite what could be said as mismanagement here in terms of the finances. So I want you to be able to respond to that, John, if you would.
Yeah, that larger question. Thank you. Yeah, that's a good question. I would remind you that in 2004, I raised these very issues with Greg, and nothing changed. When I talked to Scott Darzny on November 9th, 2010, we talked for 2 hours, and he wasn't happy. I told him right away I didn't fool him. I said, Greg, I've learned these stories are false. And I begged him for most of that 2 hours to go to Greg and say, Greg won't return my calls, Scott, but you should go to him and tell him he needs to come clean before this blows up in his face. Please tell him right now. Tell him to go to someone like Nick Kristof, who is a big believer, and Kristof will treat him fairly, and get this out, get ahead of it. So my desire was not to bring him down. My desire all along was to get him to reform. And I tried for years. Countless other other staffers who I interviewed had tried, and he just shut him out and refused to listen. It wasn't until he was confronted with, you know, Greg, this is public, man. It's like, you know, I warned Darsney. I said, Scott, you need to, you know, he's going to be like James Fry in Million Little Pieces, who was forced to confess on Oprah's couch, or Lance Armstrong. You don't want that. Go to someone who's sympathetic, like Christiane Amanpour or Christoph. Get him to, you know, come clean, and people will forgive. People love Greg. They'll forgive him. Do it now, please. I begged him. That didn't happen. So this allegation that I was, you know, I now support a charity started by two of Greg's program managers. Once they found out he was corrupt, they started their own charity. I support them. I support many other charities that improve the lives of women and children in this part of the world. So the fact that I'm, you know, out to harm women and children is terrible. Well, let me just say, you know, of all the hijackers on 9/11, all the pilots of those planes and many of their supporters were educated at Western universities. I'm not saying education is a wonderful thing. People need to be educated, kids in these worlds. But if you think that that's going to deter people from becoming radicalized, you know, those 9/11 pilots are pretty strong evidence otherwise.
So 60 Minutes was your way to clean up this organization?
Not my preferred way, not at all. As I just pointed out, I tried as hard as I could to, you know, and many others tried too over a period of, you know, 11 years. And Greg is in his own world. You know, he is this. Greg is a damaged person. I don't know what's wrong with him. I know he, you know, he can't help lying even when there's no point. You know, in his book, he talks about, you know, standing at with Mother Teresa after she died in the spring of 2000. Well, she died 3 years earlier after the date of his
okay,
story.
Can I
he
ask
makes
you
up
a
this
question,
beautiful
John?
Story.
Can I ask
sure.
you a question? When I asked to interview you and you mentioned the email back and forth that we had, that conversation ended when you threatened me. And I want to read the threat so people understand what we're talking about and ask you.
Not unless I have a chance to explain it, because I'll tell you what
you
I meant.
You have a chance. This comes up in the film.
Yeah, yep. let me just read the threat here. If I learn this woman, who you had identified to me as a source, has been harassed or persecuted in any way, I will consider you responsible and take every action at my disposal to hold you accountable. And make no mistake, you will be extremely sorry if I feel the need to do this. What did you mean?
Well, that woman had told me she feared because Greg's, you know, his supporters.
So what do you? No. I'm asking you what you meant in threatening me.
That I would do what I'm doing right now. That I am doing right what I'm doing right now. That I would expose that your film is in its own way an outrageous act of deceit. And that's what I meant by that. So yeah, it's happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask finally. Jennifer, and this is the bigger sort of question. We don't have a lot of time for both of you to respond to this. I think in the film you concede, and you there are moments in the film where you acknowledge that there were some sort of clumsy attempts at this, that Greg didn't respond in responsible ways to these certain things. But I guess what you're saying is, does that matter? Does it matter that Corfe didn't exactly happen the way he played out in light of, again, that bigger picture? And John Cracker, why don't you respond to that? Let's give Jennifer the final word on that point. That this, it doesn't really matter, John, because children
absolutely
are being
it
educated.
Okay. It absolutely, because we don't know how many children are educated. If Greg, you know, if you gave Greg $100 or $1,000, like me, $75,000, when I learned that half of that money has been wasted and bought vacations and luggage for Greg, I'm going,
oh,
are you
please,
kidding
enough
me?
Of the vacations and luggage. And
you're enough of it. It's the nonprofit
time.
World isn't regulated. It's very lax IRS regulations. People need to believe it's tax subsidized businesses, nonprofit businesses. They need to believe that the leaders of those organizations are telling them the truth, that they're monitoring how that money's spent, that it's being effective, they're respectful of the donors and how that money came to them. And in Greg's case, that is categorically untrue. You know, so many millions were wasted. There was so much negligence. There was so much fraud and corruption. I mean, that is, you can't excuse that by saying, yeah, but look at the schools we did build. Look at the girls we did educate. That money could have educated twice as many girls if you hadn't wasted it. You know, that's my point.
I don't excuse it, but I do. Yeah, I don't excuse it. What I do say is that we are not dealing with an American paradigm. And the fact that he was able to build the number of schools he did is an incredible achievement. Were there mistakes? Absolutely. Was money, you know, not Did it get lost in Pakistan, Afghanistan? Yes, some of it did. We're dealing with a very corrupt culture over there. But the fact that 1,000 people every year over there are being learned to read and write, 450 projects, 100,000 people impacted by these, by Central Asia Institute projects every year. It's an incredible achievement. There are mistakes. And Greg has owned them. The board has owned them. But the bottom line, I think, particularly given where we are in the world right now, is that the education of these villages, of these people, is crucially more important than trying to put an American sensibility on this area of the world. As I said earlier, USAID has spent $14 billion, and they don't have a roof to show for it. American Red Cross just raised $500 million for Haiti and built 6 homes. It's amazing the amount of achievement that has happened on the ground and that continues to today.
It's Jennifer Jordan. Her documentary film addressing these allegations against Greg Mortensen is called 3,000 Cups of Tea. She joined us today from radio station WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Jennifer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Doug.
And John Krakauer's book, Criticizing Mortensen's Stories, published in 2011. It's called Three Cups of Deceit. You can also see some updates on this story in, if you go to Medium, I'm going to put links to that as well. John, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.